Packet Pushers.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of Packet Protector, the podcast at the intersection of networking and security. I'm Jennifer J.J. Manella here with Drew Conry Murray, and we have a fantastic guest for you guys today. We're talking to Chris Greer. Chris is a Wireshark trainer and consultant specializing in the art of packet analysis. And if you've ever done anything like try to learn about Wireshark and Googled Wireshark training or looked at YouTube, you've probably seen one of Chris's videos already before. He's got some great training out there. So we're going to talk to Chris about packet analysis, Wireshark, other tools. And we dive into a little bit about who and what Wireshark is, because it is its own independent nonprofit now. There is an event coming up in June that's in person over here on the East Coast. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And then, you know, just diving into packet analysis in the context of security, how that works, when to use it, when to use a tool, when to use a human. And Drew?
Yeah, if you think that packet analysis is just for the networking side of the house for troubleshooting, Chris has some surprises for you. It is definitely an InfoSec tool.
Yeah, I wanted you to say thrunting.
Oh, sorry. And thrunting, of course. Or threat hunting, thrunting.
Yeah. So Chris digs into using packet analysis and threat hunting and incident response. Let's get going with Chris. Okay, Chris, just in case somebody listening doesn't know, because we have a breadth of listeners here, let's just give us the nickel tour of like, what is packet analysis as a starting point?
Okay. Thanks for that question. And I think it's a good one to cover, especially given the first word of this podcast. We do protect them. So what are they? So packets are basically a basic data set. It's a basic data unit that is exchanged between machines. Right now, we're all communicating in words. Those words go together to make sentences. Sentences all go together to make thoughts that are exchanged. And if I say, hey, JJ, did you hear me? Do you understand? I wait for a response and JJ says whatever comes to her mind.
Yes, I heard you.
An acknowledgement. So packets are very similar to that in the way computers and systems communicate. So they exchange packets over a packet switch network, which is what networks we refer to today. And analysis is simply recording and replaying and analyzing that traffic to see if there's any types of hitches, glitches, or any type of strange behavior within that traffic. Really, you could relate it to recording a conversation. Right now, we're recording this, and the listeners are listening into it. But just imagine if they were analyzing the conversation that we were having. Like, why did it take JJ half a second to respond to that question?
Sometimes, you know, JJ is slow and there's a little mental latency happening.
She was sipping her coffee, right? So we need to get JJ that coffee faster. And maybe Chris was having a problem processing the acknowledgement. So maybe the acknowledgement was lost and he never heard it. So then JJ's got to acknowledge again. So exactly that idea is what packet analysis is. It's listening into conversations between computers.
Drew.
Yes.
Since we have Chris, I think at the end of today's show, we should make up our own little packet cheer. Like, we love packets. Yes, we do. We love packets. How about you? Are you guys on? Are you on board for that?
I love this.
No.
I'm going to be the stick in the mud, but you guys go for it.
Drew's a hard no. I think Chris was on. That's okay, Chris. You and I, we'll circle back on this later. We'll get something cool together.
So we just saw Drew give a reset.
It's more of a vibe reset than anything.
I did an application level acknowledgement. I was like, 200 okay, let's do it.
You know, I've heard about packet analysis in the context of networking, particularly around troubleshooting, but this is also a security podcast. So are there use cases for security? And if so, do you have examples?
Yes. And I would go back to the first word in this podcast, the title. You know, it's packet protector. So in order to protect them, it's good to understand them and what they do, what they say. So just a quick little backstory before I directly get into the meat of the answer. For a long time, I was doing troubleshooting, break fix analysis, performance analysis with Wireshark. And that was what people would call me up to do. Something was slow. Something was broken. Let's get a packet capture and let's see what's going on. And in the last, I would say 5-6 years or so, while doing exercises like that, my clients have started to pivot into asking me questions like, hey, what else is going on in that traffic? Is there anything weird? Do you see any IOCs? Have we been compromised by this malware? Do we have this type of breach? Or we've had this kind of weird behavior. Do you see anything that looks funny at the packet level? Things that perhaps our IDS, IPS systems, our SIEM data isn't catching.
And how do you find that needle in a haystack? Like, do you have a general idea of what you're looking for before you start digging into this? I mean, anybody that's looked at a packet capture, there's a lot of stuff happening in there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. And let me take that question in just a second, because I think it's a very important one for sure. But yeah, I think more and more, absolutely, yes, packets belong in the cybersecurity space, the security space. And I think that the gap of knowledge in that space is a big gap. And that's why those that have seen any of my content on YouTube and otherwise have started to see me pivot more into trying to fill that gap of knowledge in the cybersecurity space. And back to your question, JJ, how do you actually do it? How can you go threat hunting at the packet level? How can you support, validate, and even fact check your IDS systems, not just hoping they catch everything? So if you'd like, we can chat just a moment about that question, JJ.
Yeah, and we like to call it threatening because of a friend guest that we had on the show one time. So feel free to use threatening as you see fit.
I think I heard that one. I like it. So you can threat the packets.
Packet threatening.
Did we just come up with a new podcast title?
Yep. We can work this into our new cheerleader.
Sweet.
Now I'm on board. If we're getting threatening in there, I'm on board.
Okay. So how do you find weird? Well, the best way to identify something as weird is to know what normal is. So for me, something that I do is really try to get a baseline of how should things look under normal conditions. And then as you develop that skill set, you start to see outliers. You start to see aberrations from normal. It's the same thing. Maybe one example I could use. Hey, JJ, if you and I are going to find counterfeit money and they just dumped a big stack of dollar bills in front of us, I mean, the best thing we could do is know what a real one looks like. And then we go to work. But what does the real one have? What signatures does it have? How does it look? And then we can just rip through that stack and look for any outliers. Even if the fakes are really good, there's absolute things that should be there. So it helps us to identify. So the wrong way to go about it is to try to study every counterfeit. The best way to go about it is to study the real one.
Yeah. And I think that's true in everything with security or even troubleshooting, right? Like anything technology related, it's hard to jump into something and try to find that anomaly or that outlier if you don't understand how it normally could or should be working before you're looking for the weird thing.
Absolutely. 100%. I mean, I would feel that way if I was just put into the cockpit of an airplane. Like, and if you ask me, well, what's going wrong?
Well, the first thing is that a pilot is not in the chair, but
right, exactly. The pilot's not
Captain
here.
Obvious here.
Yeah. Let's just say he was and he was helping to fly the plane. Chris, your first job is to find what's looking weird in this cockpit. Well, I'm like, well, thanks. Everything looks weird. I have no idea what any of these buttons are, what they do. And I understand. So that's how Wireshark can fill in doing packet analysis at the beginning. And that's an example I use in my courses that I teach. Just, hey, this can feel pretty overwhelming. It looks like you're looking at the matrix. It's like, what is normal? So that's why I advocate learning the mechanics of basic protocol structures. And I'm not talking about, you know, tens and tens and tens of different protocols. Like you have to become an expert on 100 different protocols. I'm talking about there's just the Fab Five. If you learn DCP, UDP, IP, ARP, I'm going over five, but just DHCP, DNS, just core protocols. Uh-huh. If you learn how those things work under normal conditions and how should they work, let's look at some RFCs, let's look at some examples, let's look at our own environment. Then when there are strange things happening, it's so much easier to spot.
Have you found anything juicy and fun and weird?
Oh, absolutely. And a lot of times when it was already in play, when my client was unaware of it being there, and when they already had other systems in place to try to find it. One time I was doing some analysis for a client that I had, and we were troubleshooting a slow backend database problem. Like this whole application was just dog slow during certain times. So we focused our analysis there. We're trying to figure out how the application was communicating and so on. And during that, I found like this long running TCP conversation that was communicating directly to the database, and it wasn't going through the application array. And it was coming from this just strange address out there in the world. And I wasn't sure the complete architecture of the whole system, right? I was just looking at this one application. So I asked my client, like, what systems do you have out there? Maybe a cloud environment, maybe something that should be just going directly for this thing. And they're like, oh, that machine, that database doesn't talk out at all.
So it's not like some backup service that's hosted by a third, you know, something normal-ish like that.
That's where I was going. I was like, is this thing kind of phoning home somewhere that we know about? Because it looks like it's phoning home. And they said, no, that thing doesn't talk out. And I was like, do clients ever directly access this thing? Is there any reason for them to bypass the front end and go straight to that back end? And they're saying, absolutely not. That shouldn't happen. And I'm like, well, how about this conversation right here? And I'll stop the story there just to protect the guilty and the innocent. But sadly, it's becoming more and more usual. It's something that I find more often these days. Like, they just have some strange indicators out there. And sometimes that can happen because these are conversations that are happening between machines that simply are communicating on parts of the network or across parts of the network where our IDS IPS systems aren't watching. They can't be everywhere.
So I know you're stopping the story to protect the innocent and the guilty, as you said, but I'm assuming what the outcome of this is, there was some unknown or unauthorized communication happening directly into that server that should not have been happening.
Yes, it looked dangerously close to some C2 traffic that was happening over a long running TCP connection, phoning home basically. And that's where their security team took over and did what they do. And that's, you know, as a packet analyst, that's where, you know, when you're for hire, then they're like, okay, thanks, Chris, bye.
And I'm like, well, don't let the door hit you in the butt.
All right, no, thank you. We appreciate you. You know, I point them at the burning building and then, now get out of here, you know. So
that's nice, though, because look, incident response, I don't know, maybe you like it. I very specifically outscope incident response. That is not a fun situation for me personally.
From my experience, I haven't had to be in that chair often. Usually I'm not called for incident response. Usually I'm called for performance weird issues and then, hey, what else is in there? Or here's a day's worth of my traffic. Do you find anything? Because I think it goes back to prevention is so expensive with so many things, health and otherwise. It's expensive to hire and maintain threat hunters in an environment, have IT people that are skilled with packets looking for things that may or may not be there. And, you know, sometimes I get involved in those types of digs, just like, hey, here's a few days of traffic. What do you find?
Well, and it's hard to be proactive when everybody's dealing with fires all day. I mean, everybody's in tech tends to be just overworked and burnout. And Drew and I have had conversations about that for sure.
Oh, absolutely. I 100% agree. I mean, all of us, you know, when do you have time to burn on an exercise that might not be fruitful? So I understand, you know, why that can be difficult. So back to your question, JJ, on how do you approach that? For me, I've just tried to really make it a point to understand how protocols work well. How should they work? Let's start with the TCP handshake. Where is it coming from? Where is it going to? What does it look like? What are the different field values within that handshake? What options are being exchanged? Do I have any open HTTP conversations going on? Do I have any old TLS versions? Because that's the thing, and we might talk about this in just a minute, but a lot of malware, spyware, badness that occurs today, sometimes I just call it lazy. You know, it's not all that way, but some still has open web calls, port 80 stuff. Some of it's using TLS 1.0, 1.1. So those kinds of things are like, well, in 2025, no modern application should be doing that. So right there's a red flag.
Although I'm wondering if in some engagements you still find applications using TLS below 1.3, just because that's how the application works. And if we change it, it could break.
That's true. Yeah. But then there's the question, right? Like, hey, I see this, to me, weird conversation over 1.1. Hey, is this expected? And if they say, oh, yeah, we haven't popped up to 1.2. And I'm like, well, then, okay, let's do that soon first. But second, you were just able to confirm that that's normal. So now I can put that at least temporarily on the normal shelf and keep digging.
You just mentioned TLS. So what about encryption? Because one of the interesting trends that we've seen and heard, like from clients, is I have been getting a lot of requests and seeing a lot of requests for like various, I don't know the right word for the product. What are they calling it these days? But basically products that sit on the network, watch all of the traffic, and then I'm going to call it behavior analysis and anomaly detection type of thing. But we're moving towards zero trust, we're moving towards encrypted communications, and we're moving towards, you know, remote workforce. But let's just look at the encryption piece of it. How much of what you see on a traditional network is encrypted, and how much is that impactful to what you're able to do or see?
I think those are very important questions that we have today, because the myth is that, well, the traffic's encrypted, so what's the point in trying to analyze it?
Right.
Right. Or encryption renders your detection systems useless.
Because one of the values of Wireshark or a packet capture tool is that you're getting header and payload if it's not encrypted. And suddenly if it's encrypted, you lose that view into the payload.
That's true. But I like what you just said. With Wireshark, you get headers and payload. So with encryption, you just lose the payload. But you still got the headers with many protocols.
So you still get the, you know, source destination. You still kind of know what's going on. You just don't know exactly the communication that's happening, the contents.
Yeah. that's exactly it. You know, and I'm back to your question. Do you see encryption everywhere on systems today? 100%. I mean, a lot of the real application carrying traffic is encrypted, but not all traffic is, for one, and not all protocols are, for two. Literally yesterday, I was doing an analysis for a client that was having some spanning tree issues at layer two. It's a layer two protocol. We were able to see how the switches were, their configuration was flipping and it was choosing a different root bridge way too often. So it was really messing with their experience as a whole. We were able to capture it and see that because STP traffic is still open, right? I mean, ARP, the IP header, we can still see source destination. We can still see IP identifiers. We can still see quality of service, class of service, diff serve. Those bits are still there for us. Any fragmentation, even into the TCP header, we have a whole TCP header. We can see port values. We can see options, how those are exchanged, window sizes. So there's a lot of things that we can still see layer four and below, even when an application is encrypted. That said, yeah, is it a challenge? Because I don't know if Drew goes to XYZ application and he's making a request and I can't see what the request actually was. It does limit my visibility, but it goes back to, why did Drew call me? Was it slow? Well, even in an encrypted application, I can still see Drew sending something to that application, probably a request. And then I see the application waiting some amount of time and then beginning to respond, probably a reply. And then I can measure those timers. That's in network performance analysis. With security, I still have, okay, Drew was talking where, on what port, how often? And is that expected? Does he normally do that? Many systems still are not encrypting DNS. DNS is still open and readable for now. That's changing.
I feel like I'm having all kinds of PTSD triggers here. When you mentioned spanning tree and I had to just tune out for a second. Unencrypted DNS.
Yeah, but the truth is it's still there in a lot of systems, right, wrong, or otherwise, and that's going away. But you know, there's still a lot of value that we can get off of the wire, even in encrypted environments.
Yeah, so I want to just underline that a little bit, because I think in a security context, folks may think, well, what I'm really looking for is malware signatures, so I need payload. And if I can't get payload, then not really useful. But you're saying even with the packet headers, you can still gain a lot of useful security information. I mean, it kind of goes back to your example. You saw this funny TCP connection and were like, well, that's odd. And that didn't require you to see payload.
Yeah, exactly. One example I use, you know, if a thief was going to break into your house, or if a thief did break into your house and you didn't know all that was observed. Okay, so the neighbors saw it. They went in, they left with this box, but they were able to tell you when it happened, how long they were in there, what the car was when they left. They were able to take pictures of the license plate. They were able to get an identification of how many people there were, what were their sizes, ages. I mean, even from external to that house, if you had video footage of that, but you just didn't know what was physically in that box, it's still, okay, we still have quite a bit to go on here. You know, we can't just throw it all out the window and say, well, unsolvable case. We don't know what was inside the box. When it comes to encryption with packets, developing that skill set as an analyst is really important, because there's so much that still is there that we can use. Also, a lot of our analysis and forensics tools that we have that are doing this 24/7, 365 are using packet data to do so. They're just doing it at a scale that us as human beings typically don't do. They're watching it all the time. So we work in conjunction with those systems to be able to investigate incidents or thrunt, to borrow that word from JJ.
I like the way you perked up like a little bird and cocked your head when you said thrunt. Drew wasn't looking. He was making notes. Thrunt. Well, that was actually going to be my next question, because in security and really in any operations, right, there's two things, right? There's the itty bitty granular, let me dig in and get my microscope and see what's going on. But then there's that zoomed out, you know, doesn't have to be 10,000 foot view, but 500 foot view of, let me get something that's a little bit more cohesive and holistic, or understand the context of this little thing I've got the microscope on. So where does, I mean, I think you were kind of getting to this, you know, the packet analysis fit from like an information security or a network professional doing something manually versus using some other tools that have that broader visibility. Where do we use that slider? Like, what are the use cases and the appropriate times to use a tool maybe that has automation built in and has a broader view? And when do we need to zoom in and do something more manual with that analysis?
I like that question. Going back to the haystack if I have this massive haystack, at least if I can get to the 2x2 cubic area where that needle is, and then start looking for a needle. So if I had some type of tool or machine that could just at least cut it down for me and focus the area I go searching for that needle, well, that just saved me a ton of time. And that's how those systems, that's their strength, right? They don't go down to the needle level, but they help us get rid of parts of the haystack. Huh. So, I mean, imagine how I feel like when a client says, hey, I got a few terabytes of data, Chris, can you go hunting? No. I mean, I don't want, there's better systems for that. So we're going to pull off a Wireshark and doing deep dive packet analysis. And we're going to do some high level things first, just to see if we have any, I mean, let's pump it through some Cercata rules. Like, what do we find? Right? Like, are there any, some Zeek logs? Like, let's just take things at a higher level view first, and then let that start to whittle down before we go into a conversation. Now let's get down to the headers. Now let's get down to the specific aspects of what those headers are saying. So I hope that helps answer that question. If you're doing like a real overview, 100,000 foot all the time, a human being with packet analysis with Wireshark is not the spot for that.
Right.
It's not until you get down to the 10, 5, 1,000 foot view.
So you need to know either what you're looking for or where to be looking for something that you don't know what it is.
Exactly. And the location too. If it's like a massive feed that's leaving a huge enterprise out to the web, you know, and they're passing gigs per second, 10, 100 gigs per second. I mean, just that capacity right there. I mean, you, if you do capture, you're not capturing for long because you're going to fill your, all your whole drive array in seconds. You know, so that's just not the best place for it. That's not what packets are. That's not their wheelhouse, right?
What about flow sampling? Like, what about technologies that don't look at every single, you know, packet in depth? Where do we use those? What's the appropriate use? And what are your thoughts about that?
I think those are good for like long-term trends, trying to find a long-term normal, right? And understanding that there's things that we miss and there's absolute things that can slip through cracks. So as long as we get that context, like, okay, we're going to do some sampling. We're going to get an analysis on every 20th conversation, but then we can store it long term and get that overall pattern. Great. Well, that's the win that you just can't get on the packet level. So
I hear some security people that turn towards flow analysis as part of a security strategy in networking. I'm kind of like, I mean, if something is repeated enough and there's enough volume, eventually, yes, you might see it. I thought maybe you had some use cases, but I think I'm just going to stick with my current thought of that's not the best way to go about it.
There's a lot of places to hide and there's a lot that can be missed. But I think in time, as things go, computing just continues to get faster, better. Storage gets faster, better. Then we'll be better. Maybe we can sample less.
JJ, I guess I'd say like the value I see for the flow log analysis is that one of the things it's for is that baseline, like what does normal look like? Mm-hmm. And this is sort of what's happening day to day, and flows collected in aggregate over time are one of the ways you can get that picture. So that when something anomalous pops up, you're like, oh, that's weird. We haven't either seen those two hosts talking or we haven't seen that kind of traffic before. That's when flow analysis, I think, comes to the fore.
And at least to maybe one use case for me that I've seen is like, okay, things are acting funny on a system, got some performance weirdness. And then we see through that flow analysis that could be sampled, we see this big spike of something, right? We just see this huge block of data for this period of time on that feed. And we can at least figure out, okay, what was that? Was that like a database popping itself out somewhere? Was it backing up somewhere? Was that expected? So there's still some answers, but JJ, I'm with you. I mean, it's a grain of salt, right? It's one way to look at a problem, sure, but does it let me sleep at night? No.
Chris, I don't know if it's fair to tie you to a number, but you mentioned a client asking you, hey, can you look at these terabytes of logs and or packets? And you're like, is there sort of a ballpark of what's an amount of data that a human could reasonably be expected to parse in a meaningful way when doing packet analysis?
Hard to put on a specific number because I know I have some friends that do some pretty awesome filtering. Mm. They can turn a terabyte into 1 gig pretty quick.
What do you mean by filtering?
Well, you can use, there's some tools within Wireshark. So Wireshark itself, well, I'll go to the command line. On the command line, you have a tool called T-Shark, Terminal Shark. And one thing that you can do with Terminal Shark is you can take a ton of data and rip through it pretty quickly and extract specific things that you might be looking for. Like I have a set of scripts that I use. If I'm ever in a case where someone sends me 100 gig of data, well, I can take T-Shark and just rip through that data and say, hey, pull out all the DNS, put it over here. Pull out anything that's less than TLS 1.2, put it over here. Pull out any HTTP, put it over here. And it creates a bunch of sub captures with just those data sets. So yeah, it takes minutes or hours to claw through it. But if I was doing that one packet at a time, yeah, weeks, months. But if I'm using T-Shark to do what it does well, then I can pre-filter. That's what I mean. If you're talking to a skilled analyst with a lot of experience, then it doesn't take a whole lot of time to go from hundreds of gigs down to a more readable packet capture. Just to give you a specific example with what I like to open, usually I like 1 gig or less once I open up Wireshark and looking at stuff. Wireshark as an analyzer is going very detailed and it's doing analytics while you open up the packet capture. So not only can it take a long time to open up anything larger than 1 gig, but it also, once you start applying filters and backing it up and applying another one, can take a long time. Mm. So that's why for me, usually a gig or less is what I like to work with. But then if I go north of that, or if I'm looking for more than that, then I start to go over to the command line to pre-shred it, as I say.
Okay, so 1 gig sort of post-filter, that's the output you like to work with. Okay.
Yes, that's my target. And where that starts, and I hope this is answering the question well, but where that starts is how we capture in the first place. So I tell my clients, don't send me 100 gig packet capture. Let's capture it from the get-go. So we'll start a capture, go up to a certain point and save, then start over, then save. Now they have 100 1 gig files instead of one massive haystack. Uh-huh. They just give me 100 smaller ones. Uh-huh. So then I can start asking, okay, so Drew, about what time did it happen? When did you start to see slowness? Now that gives me a time index. I can start to go to those packets that were around that time. I just reduced the haystack for myself. Now I'm going to focus on those PCAPs, and then I can still do some pre-filtering and ripping off some strange behaviors into smaller packet captures, making it more digestible for a human being to go in and open and start digging around. Thrunt.
Chris, I feel like now I'm old. I had to re-download Wireshark recently a few times. But when I was using this tool, like it was called, well, we were arguing, is it ethereal or ethereal or like, so for those of us, because I do think there's a lot of value in, regardless of what you're doing in technology, if you want to understand how anything works or be able to troubleshoot something, I think packet analysis is such a fundamental skill to have. It's like in dance, like you can't learn social dancing, right? Partner dancing, if you don't understand, you know, your primary foot positions and body movements, like it's never going to work well. And I kind of feel that way with, you know, some of the basics and fundamentals, understanding the OSI model, understanding IP stacks. And I think the packet analysis is such a huge piece. So for anybody going into 2025 and thinking, well, I'm going to learn something new and I'm really going to dig into something, even if it's not specifically, you know, oh, I want to learn Wireshark, but they want to learn this other thing. I'd love to kind of talk through kind of getting started, because you've got some fantastic resources out there. But let's say somebody's sitting there and they want to just, they haven't really messed with Wireshark, or maybe they've downloaded and kind of poked at it a little bit. We use it a lot when we do our wireless security training, because there's all kinds of cool filters and things. Like you can really just see what's happening and then understand, right? Like you can visualize what's happening instead of just it being theoretical at that point. So how would somebody get started if they're listening and they want to dig into this a little more?
Okay, there's several resources out there that are free that you can start with.
We like free.
Sure. I mean, Wireshark itself is free. So first download Wireshark, install it on your system. It's there for every type of system, which by the way, tangent, I was always like an ethereal kind of, that's how I said it.
Yep.
Because Ethernet, you don't see Ethernet.
Yeah.
You say Ether.
I was in that camp too. We were in the same camp together. Yeah.
Yeah. That is, so anyway, back to Wireshark, but it changed names in 2006 and here we are, Wireshark.
Before you go on with the resources, because we were kind of talking about this a little before we started recording, who manages and maintains Wireshark? Because it's free. How is this funded? Who's managing it?
So Wireshark is supported by the Wireshark Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization that Gerald Combs is the original developer of Wireshark, and he's the chairman of the board, so to speak, and there's others that support him in that effort, many of them core developers of Wireshark. So Wireshark is a independently non-funded nonprofit organization. So that's why, and I appreciate you bringing that up, Wireshark is on its own. Every download costs money, and it's mainly supported by a volunteer organization of developers from around the world that donate their time to make this thing better. So if you are listening to this podcast and you use Wireshark to do whatever it is you're doing, whether you're learning, whether you're making your network run better or securing it with Wireshark and looking at packet data that way, you know, just give that a thought. I mean, consider supporting the foundation. To do that, if you just head to wireshark.org, there's a donate button. There's ways that you can get your employer involved. There's conferences that are available that you can attend that will all support the Wireshark Foundation. So that's something that listeners can check out.
Wasn't Wireshark getting funding from Riverbed at some point? And did that stop?
It switched hands several times. Riverbed was involved for a time, most recently Sysdig. It went from Riverbed to Sysdig, and now from Sysdig became a nonprofit. Several reasons for that. It's allowed the project to be a bit more nimble and to go in the direction that they want to keep it going. Not to say that any of those companies didn't support that, but they've always wanted to be a nonprofit organization on their own. So yes, while historically there have been a vendor with some deeper pockets supporting them, that's not the case today.
Okay, good to know.
And it takes a village, because I mean, really, even if just $1 or $5, right, to donate and support, that would be a huge thing.
Yeah. With Wireshark's user base. Yeah. That would make a tremendous difference and help it. I mean this seriously, help it continue.
Yeah. And you guys, all of the things that Chris is mentioning, we'll put all the links in the show notes for you so you can click on them there. Let me let you get back to that list of the getting started resources.
Sure. Yeah. So I would say first, I hate to do a self plug, but my YouTube channel is very focused on the new person. So if you just download it, don't know where to start, come on by my channel. If you just look on YouTube, Chris Greer, if you do Chris Wireshark, or if you just do Wireshark, hopefully you'll find my stuff. Otherwise, I'm doing something wrong. But I strongly invite the new audience. If you're just looking to skill up in packet analysis, stop by. Core forensics, core basic protocols and use models and filters and profiles. And we go through all that. In fact, I have a 9-part, I call it the Wireshark Masterclass, and it's available there for you. You can download a packet capture, follow right along with each lesson, and gradually build your skill set. Also, from there, most of my videos, I have a link to my Udemy course. And that Udemy course is available. I think you can pick it up for like $10 or something like that.
Oh, wow.
I just refreshed it for 2025. I literally just hit publish on it with brand new fresh examples. I'm using a cutting edge version of Wireshark and all the new features and all the current filters that'll be helpful for people.
Are there like other exercises or capture the flags or activities floating around out there that are good to kind of flex that skill?
Yes. So something I do personally for myself, TryHackMe, I think, is a great resource.
TryHackMe, TryHack. Okay.
Yep. If you head on out there to TryHackMe, there's several Wireshark rooms, and a room is an environment where you put on a virtual machine and you have several different packet captures to open and look through. There's also several CTFs on TryHackMe. Also some other CTF, I mean, just, man, if you just Google CTF and packet analysis or CTF Wireshark, I'm sure you'll find some. Pico CTF is another great one.
Oh, Pico CTF.
Honestly, like for the listening audience, I personally keep my eyes open for packet-centric CTFs to keep my skill set fresh, to try to learn new things. Even at DEF CON, doing the packet challenge they have there is always fun. And I find, I just haven't had to use Wireshark that way. I just learned something. So Learning never stops. No one's an expert. And if you are, it only lasts a day. So
speaking of learning, you mentioned an engagement where you asked the client to get you, you know, 1 gig intervals of 100 gig of traffic, which makes me think they maybe had some sophisticated packet brokering in place. Do I need that to start getting packets and using Wireshark?
No, you don't need any expensive equipment, a packet broker, or a large capture environment to be able to get started. In fact, I think that it's too late to start once you have that stuff. If you start now in a simple way, even just capturing your own machine's traffic and just seeing what's going on out there, everybody can do that right now. Right now, this podcast, you're listening to it. It's a little harder on a mobile device, but if you're on a laptop, start up Wireshark, fire it up. What protocol is this podcast using to deliver this content to you? And when you stop this podcast, does that traffic stop? What other protocols do you see? What other conversations do you see? Just doing that gets your skills going. You're learning how to drive in the parking lot. You're going out to a mall when the shops are closed and you're just learning how to drive and park and back up and do the things before you head out on the highway. I can't tell you the amount I've learned about Wireshark and setting filters and how traffic works. Not for any bad reason, but just at a coffee shop, at an airport, bored on a plane, just fire it up and see what you see.
Oh, Chris is that guy. Chris is that guy. I've seen that guy. I've had wireless tools on airplanes, and I've seen some stuff, and I'm like, who the sitting on this airplane doing that right now.
That seems like an invitation for an air marshal to be like, hey, buddy, what you got there?
Hey, they haven't yet, but hopefully they don't.
It's just looky-looky, though, right?
Yeah.
It's looky-looky. You're not doing anything.
Nah, exactly.
So when you said flying the plane, you weren't really kidding. That's your ambition someday, right? Just fly it from your laptop.
Exactly. And it just to see, you know, it's interesting, you know, what we think is happening and what really is happening on the wire can be two very different things. You know, right now my phone is sitting on my desk and the screen's off and I'm not interacting with it. So standard person thinks, oh, it's not doing anything until you fire up Wireshark and see what it's really doing. You know, so that curiosity, I think, I know we've kind of gone on about it, but I think one of the most important things to have to develop this skill set is just curiosity.
Yeah.
And a desire to learn something interesting and new. And if you have both of those things, boy, you're going to have a very interesting, fun time in the packet level.
So maybe to wrap this up, we've sort of touched on a little bit, but just sort of put a good, clear point on it. In your opinion, you know, when should the packet analyzer come out of the toolkit? What are the situations where you think, yeah, this is the time to pull this tool out? Security context.
For sure. Incident response is an important one. I'm sorry, JJ, but I'll start with that one.
That's also fine. Somebody's got to do it. There's a reason I'm co-hosting a podcast and not doing this work anymore.
Right.
Yeah. Let somebody else do it. You right. Young whippersnappers out there. Yeah.
And threat hunting. Mm-hmm. I think when we're looking at things that look strange, feel strange on the as far as performance, or even when things seem normal, firing up our packet capture, either engine or Wireshark itself, and digging around and seeing what's going on. And especially if we think in terms of the threat model or a framework and how attacks work and how they develop, packets are going to be useful when we're really looking at things that are either network-based or have some type of lateral movement or some type of C2 traffic to be able to see.
C2 meaning command and control.
Exactly. If an attack involves actions being taken within a system, like it's actually, okay, they're spending a long time doing some privilege escalation, or they're interacting with a front-end web server in a secure way, but then they're trying to do SQL injection, but it's all behind the green lock. Those are things that packets aren't as strong with because we can't see that right from the wire itself. So that's where there are some other tools that have just a stronger visibility to within the system, right? The log analysis itself, you know, there's another tool that you're going to hear a lot more from the Wireshark Foundation. It's called StrataShark.
StrataShark. Sorry, let's just enjoy that for a minute. StrataShark.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun,
so
dun,
Wireshark
dun,
dun. And StrataShark. So if I can talk about that one just for a minute.
Yeah, please.
If I'm looking for stuff on the wire, Wireshark. Stuff that actually becomes a packet and is transmitted. You know, because attackers can, you know, wipe logs, they can adjust logs, they can cover their tracks in a lot of ways internal to a system, but they can't cover their packets because they need those packets to interact with the system. So you can still see them and capture them on the wire. That said, where Wireshark leaves off is once a packet hits a system and then that packet goes into the actual protocol stack and then into that kernel. So to give us visibility in there, Gerald Combs, the Wireshark Foundation, by the time we launch this podcast, it's probably going to be out. It's only in the next week or two from now. StrataShark is a tool that you can go and download, and we can link that down below as well. But that captures system calls and logs within the system.
Oh, okay.
So this is a host-based analysis tool.
Correct. And it logs literally the system calls. So that's been an interesting blind spot that we've had for a long time from the packet level, but now a tool like that is giving us system calls logs within that system. So that can augment what Wireshark sees. And you're about to see a bunch of content from myself, from others in the Wireshark community start to embrace StrataShark as well.
Wow, that's interesting. Maybe I'm getting ahead here, but are there opportunities to coordinate a Wireshark packet capture and a StrataShark system call capture to see if incidents might be related?
So I was chatting with Gerald last week, Gerald Combs, he created Wireshark, and that was exactly my question. Like, can I go in StrataShark and say, like, what packets does this read go with?
Yeah.
And he said, that's on the plan.
Okay. agree.
Like basically export or create a filter and kick it over to Wireshark and give me the packets that were involved in that system call. Like that's pretty cool. So I think we're going to start to see those two worlds begin to intersect in the future. So yeah, so threat hunting, incident response, those are two strong places for this field of view. And also I think just as a core data set, if you are working with a tool that uses the packet as its truth, so any type of IDS, IPS systems, seems like today that so many use the raw packet as the truth, and then they have signatures that are built off of that packet data, right? So Cirqada is looking for these specific signatures, these conversations, these protocols, this pattern in the traffic, right? So if you're involved in creating rules or validating those rule sets or looking at alerts that come from those rule sets, packets are really important to learn as well, because that's where the rules come from. For me as a packet person, that's why I was studying for several cybersecurity. When I first was getting started into this whole field, I started to try to cert up and get some certifications to just try to understand some of the scope and context. And I was surprised at how much packet data was in there. Uh-huh. And we'd be given a packet capture and it's like, what Cirqada rule would you build, or snort rule? Like what would be triggered based off of this traffic? And you're like, oh, well, I get packets. So for me, that wasn't a challenge because I understood the data set. So that's why I'm an advocate. Like I think anyone that even we're going into the conversation of machine learning and AI, like we want to understand what we're automating.
Right.
Learn and understand packet data.
And along the learning lines, Chris, I was just clicking around in some of the stuff we have here in the show notes. And I see that there is, if you want some real live interaction, it looks like there's Shark Fest happening in June in Virginia. So an in-person live event. And I was just clicking around in here and I see, aside from the conference, which looks like it's 3 days in June, there's also pre-conference training. It looks like you're teaching a class there. So several opportunities to, you know, get hands-on, get some training. And you also see some TLS troubleshooting with Wireshark as an option there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So Shark Fest, it's the Wireshark Developers and Users Conference. It happens twice a year, once in the States, once in Europe. And in addition to the pre-conference classes, like one of the ones that you just mentioned, going into that week of educational, it's an educational conference. You're going to learn from some of the best in the world that are doing this, and core developers that are actually creating these dissectors, and people that are directly involved with the Wireshark project. So it's a great place to go and learn. It's something I sit as a student that week, except when I'm presenting. And the same is true with anyone there. Some of the sessions that I'm teaching, I have Wireshark core developers sitting there and participating.
That's not intimidating at all, is it?
You just gotta say, oh, yeah. 100%. I remember one of the first ones I did, you know, Gerald Combs himself walks in and sits down and I'm like, oh.
He's the person who built it and I'm going to try to explain it to him.
Yeah. I'm like, why would he care about my little session that will give him nothing? But that's not how it is there.
That's cool.
No, that's cool.
That's a sign of a good community, I think.
That's great. So please come. And those other resources that we shared as well, YouTube, Udemy, TryHackMe, Hack the Box. If you're just looking to get started and you're looking to get started for free, you can check that out.
Awesome. And we've got them all in the show notes so you guys can clicky-clicky on that.
Yeah, Chris, thank you so much. This has been amazing. We'll have a ton of links in the show notes, but just as a reminder, if folks want to find you, your website is Packet Pioneer. You're also on YouTube, Chris Greer. Look up Chris Greer, G-R-E-E-R, and Wireshark on YouTube. If you don't want to get to the links in the show notes, we'll have it there. But this has been great. Fantastic discussion. We're going to have you back and dig in more because there's more here. But in the meantime, thank you so much. And as always, thanks to you, the listener, for joining us for this episode of Packet Protector. If you have a topic you want to cover, you can find JJ and I on LinkedIn or at packetpushers.net/community, where you can join our free Slack channel and hang out with other IT and security pros. If you've got a comment, a correction, or a question about anything you heard on the show, you can reach out to us at packetpushers.net/FU. The FU is for follow-up, and we really appreciate when listeners reach out. As always, eat your security vegetables.